familiar golden light. The others began to jeer. "Liar!" they chorused in unison. "I only steal because this wicked world won't let me work an honest trade," Carlo cried, hoisting his own glass. "Liar! I only steal because I have to support my poor lazy twin brother, whose indolence broke our mother's heart," Galdo elbowed Carlo as he made this announcement. "Liar!
I only steal," said Jean, "because I've temporarily fallen in with bad company."
"Liar!"
At last the ritual came to bug. The boy raised his glass a bit shakily and yelled,
"I only steal because it's heaps of fucking fun!"
"Bastard!"
With a general clamor of whooping and hollering, the five thieves banged glasses together. Light glittered on crystal and shone through the misty green depths of Ferrari mint wine. The four men drained their glasses in one go and slammed them back down on the tabletop. Bug, already a bit cross-eyed, handled his somewhat more delicately.
"Gentlemen, I hold in my hands the first fruits of all our long weeks of study and suffering."
Locke held up a rolled parchment embossed with ribbons and a blue wax seal, the colour of the lesser nobility of Camor.
"A letter of credit for 5,000 full crowns, to be drawn tomorrow against Don Salvara's funds at Maraggio's, and, I dare say, the first score our youngest member has ever helped us to bring in."
"Barrel boy!"
the Sansa brothers hollered in unison. A moment later, a small almond-crusted bread roll arced from between their seats, hit Bug right between the eyes, and plopped down onto his empty plate. Bug tore it in half and responded in kind, aiming well despite his wobbliness. Locke continued, speaking as Carlo scowled and rubbed crumbs out of his eyes.
"Second touch this afternoon was easy, but we wouldn't have gotten so far so fast if not for Bug's quick action yesterday. What a stupid, reckless, idiotic, ridiculous damn thing to do! I haven't the words to express my admiration."
Locke had managed to work a bit of wine bottle legerdemain while speaking. The empty glasses were suddenly full.
"To Bug, the new bane of the Camor City Watch!"
When the cheering and the guzzling from this toast had subsided, and Bug had been smacked upon the back often enough to turn the contents of his skull sideways, Locke produced a single large glass, set it in the middle of the table, and filled it slowly.
"Just one thing more before we can eat."
He held the glass up as the others fell silent.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We miss old Chains terribly, and we wish his soul peace. May the crooked warden ever stand watch and bless his crooked servant. He was a good and penitent man in the manner of our kind."
Gently, Locke set the glass in the center of the table and covered it with a small black cloth.
"He would have been very proud of you, Bug."
"I do hope so."
The boy stared at the covered glass in the middle of the opulent glassware and gilded cookery.
"I wish I could have met him."
"You would have been a restful project for his old age."
Jean kissed the back of his own left hand, the benedictory gesture of the nameless 13th's priesthood. "A very welcome respite from what he endured raising the four of us."
"Jean's being generous. He and I were saints. It's the Sansa brothers that kept the poor old bastard up late praying 6 nights out of 7.
Locke reached out toward one cloth-covered platter.
"Let's eat. Praying that you and Jean would grow up quick and handsome like the two of us, you mean?"
Galdo's hand darted out and caught Locke's at the wrist.
"Aren't you forgetting something?"
"Am I?"
Carlo, Galdo, and Jean met this question with a coordinated stare. Bug looked sheepish and gazed up at the chandelier.
"God's damn it!"
Locke slid out of his gold-gilded chair and went to a side cupboard. When he returned to the table, he had a tiny sampling glass in his hand, little more than a thimble for liquor.
Into this he let slip the smallest dash of mint wine. He didn't hold his glass up, but pushed it into the center of the table, beside the glass under the black cloth. A glass poured in air for an absent someone. I don't know where she is at the moment, and I pray you all choke, save Bug. Thanks very fucking much.
Hardly a graceful blessing, especially for a priest.
Carlo kissed the back of his own left hand and waved it over the tiny glass.
She was one of us even before you were, Garista.
You know what I do pray?
Locke set his hands on the edge of the table, his knuckles rapidly turning white.
That maybe some day one of you finds out what love is when it travels farther up than the buttons of your trousers. It takes two to break a heart.
Galdo gently placed his left hand over Locke's right.
I don't recall her fucking things up without your able assistance. And I dare say, said Carlo, that it would be a tremendous relief to us all if you would just have the courtesy to go out and get yourself wenched, long and hard. Gods, do three at once. It's not as though we don't have the funds. I'll have you know my patience for this topic was exhausted long before...
Locke's voice was rising to a shout when Jean grabbed him firmly by his left biceps. Jean's fist wrapped easily all the way around Locke's arm.
She was our good friend, Locke. Was and still is. You owe her something a bit more godly than that.
Jean reached out for the wine bottle, then filled the little glass to its brim. He raised it into the light and took his other hand off Locke's arm.
A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabbatha well. For ourselves, we pray brotherhood.
Locke stared at him for a second that seemed like minutes, then let out a long sigh.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ruin the occasion. That was a poor toast, and I repent it. I should have thought better of my responsibilities.
I'm sorry, too. Galdo grinned sheepishly. We don't blame you for the way you feel. We know she was...
her.
Well, I'm not sorry about the wenching bit,
Carlo shrugged in mock apology.
I'm fucking serious, man. Dip your wick, drop your anchor, go see a lady about a sheath for a dagger. You'll feel better.
Isn't it obvious that I'm just ecstatic right now? I don't need to feel better, because you and I still have work to do this evening. For the love of the crooked warden, can we please just kill this subject and throw its godsdamned corpse in the bay?
Sorry, Carlo said after a few seconds and a well-aimed glare from Jean.
Sorry. Look, you know we mean well. We're both sorry if we push. But she's in parley and we're in Camor, and it's obvious you...
Carlo would have said something else, but an almond roll bounced off the bridge of his nose, and he flinched in surprise. Another roll hit Galdo in the forehead. One arced into Jean's lap, and Locke managed to throw up a hand in time to swat down the one intended for him.
Honestly!
Bug clutched still more rolls in his outstretched hands, and he pointed them like loaded crossbows.
Is this what I get to look forward to when I grow up? I thought we were celebrating being richer and cleverer than everyone else.
Locke looked at the boy for just a moment, then reached out and took the full sampling glass from Jean, a smile breaking out as he did so.
Bug's right. Let's cut the shit and have dinner.
He raised the glass as high as he could toward the light of the chandelier.
To us, richer and cleverer than everyone else. Richer and cleverer than everyone else, came the echoing chorus. We toast absent friends who helped to bring us to where we are now. We do miss them.
Locke set the little glass to his lips and took a minuscule sip before he set it back down.
And we love them still, he added quietly.
3. The Thorn of Camor. It's a particularly ridiculous rumour that floats around the dining parlour when some of the more excitable dons don't water their wine quite thoroughly enough.
"The Thorn of Camor," said the scarred man pleasantly, "walked off your pleasure barge early this evening with a signed note for 5,000 of your white iron crowns."
"Who? Lucas Fairwhite?"
"None other."
"Lucas Fairwhite is a Vadran. My mother was Vadran. I know the tongue. Lucas is old Emberlane all the way through. He covers himself in wool and flinches back 6 feet any time a woman blinks at him."
Don Lorenzo pulled his optics off in irritation and set them on his desk.
"The man would bet the lives of his own children against the price he could get for barrels of herring guts on any given morning. I've dealt with his kind too many times to count. That man is no Camorri, and he is no mythical thief."
"My lord, you are 24, yes?"
"For the time being, is that quite relevant?"
"You have no doubt known many merchants in the years since your mother and father passed away. May they have the peace of the long silence. Many merchants, and many of them Vadrans, correct?"
"Quite correct."
"And if a man, a very clever man, wishes you to think him a merchant, well, what would he dress up and present himself as? A fisherman? A mercenary archer?"
"I don't grasp your meaning."
"I mean, my lord Salvara, that your own expectations have been used against you. You have a keen sense for men of business, surely. You've grown your family fortune several times over in your brief time handling it. Therefore, a man who wished to snare you in some scheme could do nothing wiser than to act the consummate man of business, to deliberately manifest all of your expectations, to show you exactly what you expected and desired to see."
"It seems to me that if I accept your argument," the Don said slowly, "then the self-evident truth of any legitimate thing could be taken as grounds for its falseness. I say Lucas Fairwhite is a merchant of Emberlane because he shows the signs of being so. You say those same signs are what prove him counterfeit. I need more sensible evidence than this."
"Let me digress then, my lord, and ask another question."
The scarred man drew his hands within the black folds of his cloak and stared down at the young nobleman.
"If you were a thief who preyed exclusively on the nobility of our serene Duchy of Camor, how would you hide your actions?"
"Exclusively? Your Thorn of Camor again. There can't be any such thief. There are arrangements, the secret peace. Other thieves would take care of the matter as soon as any man dared breach the peace."
"And if our thief could evade capture, if our thief could conceal his identity from his fellows?"
If. They say the Thorn of Camor steals from the rich." Don Salvara placed a hand on his own chest. "And gives every last copper to the poor. But have you heard of any bags of gold being dumped in the street in Catch Fire lately? Any charcoal burners or knackers suddenly walking around in silk waistcoats and embroidered boots? Please. The Thorn is a commoner's ale tale. Master swordsman, romancer of ladies, a ghost who walks through walls. Ridiculous."
"Your doors are locked and all your windows are barred. Yet here we are in your study, my lord."
"Granted, but you're men of flesh and blood."
"So it's said. We're getting off the subject. Our thief, my lord, would trust you and your peers to keep his activities concealed for him. Hypothetically speaking, if Lucas Fairwhite were the Thorn of Camor, and you knew that he had strolled off with a small fortune from your coffers, what would you do? Would you rouse the watch, cry for aid openly in the court of his grace, speak of the matter in front of Don Paleri Jacopo?"
I That's an interesting point. I wonder...
Would you want the entire city to know that you'd been taken in? That you'd been tricked? Would men of business ever trust your judgment again? Would your reputation ever truly recover?
I suppose it would be a very difficult thing.
The scarred man's right hand reappeared, gloveless and pale against the darkness of the cloak, one finger pointing outward.
Her ladyship, the Doña Rosalina de Mare, lost 10,000 crowns 4 years ago, in exchange for titles to upriver orchards that don't exist.
A second finger curled outward.
Don and Doña Felucia lost twice as much 2 years ago. They thought they were financing a coup in Talisham that would have made the city a family estate. Last year, the scarred man said as a third finger unfolded, Don Javariz paid 15,000 full crowns to a soothsayer who claimed to be able to restore the old man's firstborn son to life.
The man's little finger snapped out, and he waved his extended hand at Don Lorenzo.
Now we have the Don and Doña Salvara involved in a secret business deal that is both tempting and convenient. Tell me, have you ever heard of the troubles of the lords and ladies I have named?
No.
Doña de Mare visits your wife in her garden twice weekly. They discuss alchemical botany together. You've played cards with the sons of Don Javaris many times, and yet this is all a surprise to you?
Yes, quite, I assure you.
It was a surprise to His Grace as well. My master has spent 4 years attempting to follow the slender threads of evidence connecting these crimes, my lord. A fortune the size of your own vanished into thin air, and it took ducal orders to pry open the lips of the wronged parties, because their pride compelled their silence.
Don Lorenzo stared at the surface of his desk for a long moment.
Fairwhite has a suite at the Tumble home. He has a manservant, superior clothes, 100-crown optics. He has proprietary secrets of the House of Bel-Oster.
Don Salvara looked up at the scarred man as though presenting a difficult problem to a demanding tutor.
Things that no thief could have.
Would fine clothes be beyond the means of a man with more than 40,000 stolen crowns at his command? And his cask of unaged brandy? How would you or I or any other man outside the House of Bel-Oster know what it should look like, or what it should taste like? It's a simple fraud.
He was recognized on the street by a solicitor, one of the Razona law scribes who sticks to the walls at Maraggio's.
Of course he was, because he began building the identity of Lucas Fairwhite long ago, probably before he ever met Doña de Mare. He has a very real account at Maraggio's, opened with real money 5 years ago. He has every outward flourish that a man in his position should bear. But Lucas Fairwhite is a ghost, a lie, a stage role performed for a very select private audience. I have tracked him for months.
We are sensible people, Sophia and I. Surely we would have seen something out of place.
Out of place? The entire affair has been out of place. My Lord Salvara, I implore you, hear me carefully. You are a financier of fine liquors. You say a prayer to your mother's shade each week at a Vajran temple. What a fascinating coincidence that you should chance upon a needy Vajran who happens to be a dealer in the same field, eh?
Where else but the Temple of Fortunate Waters would a Vajran pray while visiting Camor?
Nowhere, of course. But look at the coincidences piling heavily upon one another. A Vadran liquor merchant in need of rescue, and he just so happens to be on his way to visit Don Jacobo, your blood enemy, a man that everyone knows you would crush by any means the Duke hadn't forbidden you.
Were you observing us when I first met him?
Yes, very carefully. We saw you and your man approach that alley to rescue a man you thought to be in danger. We
thought he was being strangled.
Was he? The men in those masks were his accomplices, my lord. The fight was staged. It was a means to introduce you to the imaginary merchant and his imaginary opportunity. Everything you value was used to bait the trap. Your sympathies for Vadrans, your sense of duty, your courage, your interest in fine liquors, your desire to best Don Jacobo. And can it be a coincidence that Fair White's scheme must be secret, that it runs on an extremely short and demanding schedule, that it just happens to feed your every known ambition?
The Don stared at the far wall of his study, tapping his fingers against his desk at a gradually increasing tempo.
"This is quite a shock,"
he said at last, in a small voice without any fight left in it.
"Forgive me for that, my Lord Salvara. The truth is unfortunate. Of course, the Thorn of Camor isn't 10 feet tall. Of course, he can't walk through walls. But he is a very real thief. He is posing as a Vadran named Lucas Fairwhite, and he does have 5,000 crowns of your money, with an eye for 20,000 more.
I must send men to Maraggio's, so he can't exchange my note in the morning," said Don Lorenzo.
"Respectfully, my lord, you must do nothing of the sort. My instructions are clear. We don't just want the Thorn. We want his accomplices, his contacts, his sources of information, his entire network of thieves and spies. We have him in the open now, and we can follow him as he goes about his business. One hint that his game is unmasked, and he will bolt. The opportunity we have may never present itself again. His Grace Duke Nicovante is quite adamant that everyone involved in these crimes must be identified and taken. Toward that end, your absolute cooperation is requested and required in the Duke's name."
"What am I to do, then?"
"Continue to act as though you are entirely taken in by Fairwhite's story. Let him exchange the note. Let him taste some success. And when he returns to you asking for more money..."
"Yes?"
"Why, give it to him, my lord. Give him everything he asks."
4. Once the dinner dishes were cleared away, and a tipsy Bug was given the task of setting them asparkle with warm water and white sand...
"Excellent for your moral education,"
Jean had cried, as he'd heaped up the porcelain and crystal. Locke and Carlo withdrew to the burrow's wardrobe to begin preparations for the third and most critical touch of the Don Salvara game. The elderglass cellar beneath the house of Perelandro was divided into 3 areas. One of them was the kitchen, another was split into sleeping quarters with wooden partitions, and the third was referred to as the wardrobe. Long clothes racks stretched across every wall of the wardrobe, holding hundreds of pieces of costuming organized by origin, by season, by cut, by size, and by social class. There were sackcloth robes, laborers' tunics, and butchers' aprons with dried bloodstains. There were cloaks of winter weight and summer weight, cheaply woven and finely tailored, unadorned or decorated with everything up to precious metal trim and peacock feathers. There were robes and accessories for most of the Therin priestly orders, Perelandro, Morgante, Nara, Sendovani, Yono, and so forth. There were silk blouses and cunningly armored doublets, gloves and ties and cravats, enough canes and walking sticks to outfit a mercenary company of hobbled old men. Chains had started this collection more than 20 years before, and his students had added to it with the wealth gained from years of schemes. Very little worn by the gentleman bastards went to waste. Even the foulest-smelling, sweat-soaked summer garments were washed and dusted with alchemical pomanders and hung carefully. They could always be fouled up again, if needed. A man-height looking-glass dominated the heart of the wardrobe. Another, much smaller glass hung from a sort of pulley system on the ceiling, so that it could be moved around and positioned as necessary. Locke stood before the larger mirror dressed in matching doublet and breeches of midnight velvet. His hose was the scarlet of blood in sunset waters, and his simple Kamori tie was a near match.
"Is this bloody melodrama really such a good idea?"
Carlo was dressed quite similarly, though his hose and his accents were grey. He pulled his tunic sleeves back above his elbows and fastened them there with black pearl clips.
"It's a fine idea," Locke said, adjusting his tie. "We're midnighters. We're full of ourselves. What sort of self-respecting spy would break into a manor house in darkest night wearing green or orange or white?"
"The sort that walked up and knocked at the door would."
"I appreciate that, but I still don't want to change the plan. Don Salvara's had a busy day. He'll be wide open for a nice shock at the end of it. Can't shock him quite the same in Lavender and Carmine."
"Well, certainly not in the way you're thinking, no."
"This doublet's damned uncomfortable in the back," Locke muttered. "Jean! Jean!"
"What is it?"
came an echoing return shout a long moment later.
"Why, I'd just love to say your name. Get in here."
Jean ambled into the wardrobe a moment later, a glass of brandy in one hand and a battered book in the other.
"I thought Grauman had the night off for this bit," he said.
"He does."
Locke gestured impatiently at the back of his doublet.
"I need the services of Camor's ugliest seamstress."
"Galdo's helping Bug wash up."
"Grab your needles, glass eyes."
Jean's eyebrows drew down above his reading optics, but he set down his book and his glass and opened a small wooden chest set against one of the wardrobe walls.
"What are you reading?"
Carlo had added a tiny silver and amethyst clip to the center of his tie and was examining himself in the small glass approvingly.
"Kim Larthen,"
Jean replied, working black thread through a white bone needle and trying not to prick his fingers.
"The Corish romances?"
Locke snorted.
"Sentimental crap. Never knew you had a taste for fairy stories."
"They happen to be culturally significant records of the Therin throne centuries," Jean said, as he stepped behind Locke, seam ripper in one hand and threaded needle in the other. "Plus at least 3 knights get their heads torn completely off by the beast of Watso."
"Illustrated manuscript, by chance?"
"Not the good parts, no." Jean fiddled with the back of the doublet as delicately as he'd ever charmed a lock or a victim's coat pocket.
"Oh, just let it out. I don't care how it looks. It'll be hidden in the back of my cloak anyway. We can pretty it up later."
"We?"
Jean snorted as he loosened the doublet with a few strategic rips and slashes. "Me, more like. You mend clothes like dogs write poetry."
"And I readily admit it. Oh, gods, much better. Now there's room to hide the sigil wallet and a few surprises, just in case."
"It feels odd to be letting something out for you rather than taking it in." Jean arranged his tools as he'd found them in the sewing chest and closed it back up.
"Do mind your training. We wouldn't want you gaining 0.5 pound. "Well, most of me is brain weight."
Locke folded his own tunic sleeves back and pinned them up as Carlo had.
"You're 1/3 bad intentions, 1/3 pure avarice, and 1/8 sawdust. What's left, I'll credit, must be brains."
"Well, since you're here and you're such an expert on my poor self, why don't you pull out the mask box and help me with my face?"
Jean paused for a sip from his brandy glass before pulling out a tall, battered wooden box inset with many dozens of small drawers.
What do we want to do first?
Your hair?
You're going black, right?
As pitch. I should only have to be this fellow 2 or 3 times.
Jean twirled a white cloth around the shoulders of Locke's doublet and fastened it in front with a tiny bone clasp. He then opened a poultice jar and smeared his fingers with the contents, a firm dark gel that smelled richly of citrus.
Looks like charcoal and smells like oranges. I'll never fathom Jessaline's sense of humour.
Locke smiled as Jean began to knead the stuff into his brown hair. Even a black apothecary needs to stay amused somehow. Remember that beef-scented knockout candle she gave us to deal with Don Felucia's damn guard dog?
Very droll, that.
Carlo frowned as he made further minute adjustments to his own finery.
Stray cats running from every corner of Camor at the scent, dropping in their tracks until the street was full of little bodies. Wind shifting all over the place, and all of us running around trying to stay ahead of the smoke.
Not our finest moment, said Jean.
His job was already nearly finished. The stuff seemed to sink into Locke's hair, imparting a natural-looking shade of deep Camori black, with only the slightest sheen. But many men in Camor used slick substances to hold or perfume their hair. This would hardly be noteworthy.
Jean wiped his fingers on Locke's white neck towel, then dipped a scrap of cloth into another poultice jar containing a pearly gel. This stuff, when applied to his fingers, cleared the residue of hair dye away as though the black gel were evaporating into thin air.
Jean dabbed the cloth at Locke's temples and neck, erasing the faint smudges and drips left over from the colouring process.
Scar? Jean asked when he was finished.
Please.
Locke ran his little finger across the line of his right cheekbone.
Slash right across there, if you would.
Jean withdrew a slender wooden tube with a chalky white tip from the mask box and drew a short line on Locke's face with it, just as Locke had indicated. Locke flinched as the stuff sizzled for a second or two. In the blink of an eye, the white line hardened into a raised, pale arc of pseudo-skin, perfectly mimicking a scar. Bug appeared through the wardrobe door at that instant, his cheeks a bit ruddier than usual. In one hand he held a black leather folding wallet, slightly larger than that which a gentleman would ordinarily carry.
"Kitchen's clean! Galdo said you'd forget this if I didn't bring it in and throw it at you."
"Please don't take him literally."
Locke held out a hand for the wallet while Jean removed the white cloth from his shoulders, satisfied that the hair dye was dry.
"Break that thing and I'll roll you to Emberlane in a barrel, personally."
The sigil inside the wallet, the intricate confection of gold and crystal and frosted glass, was by far the most expensive prop of the whole game. Even the 502 cask of Osterschalin had been cheaper. The sigil had been crafted in Talisham, 4 days' ride down the coast to the south. No Camori counterfeiter, regardless of skill, could be trusted to be quiet or comfortable about mimicking the badge of the Duke's own secret police. A stylized spider over the royal seal of the Serene Duchy. None of the gentleman bastards had ever seen one, but Locke was confident that few of the lesser nobility had either. The rough description of the dreaded sigil was whispered by the right people of Camor, and from that description a best-guess forgery had been put together.
"Durant the Gimp says that the spider's just bullshit," said Bug
as he handed over the wallet. All three older gentleman bastards in the room looked at him sharply.
"If you put Durant's brains in a thimbleful of water," said Jean, "they'd look like a ship lost in the middle of the sea."
"The Midnighters are real, Bug."
Locke patted his hair gingerly and found that his hands came away clean.
"If you're ever found breaching the peace, you'd better pray the Kappa gets to you before they do. Barsavi's the soul of mercy compared to the man that runs the Palace of Patience." "I know the Midnighters are real," said Bug. "I just said there's some that say the spider is bullshit."
"Oh, he exists.
Jean, pick out a moustache for me. Something that goes with this hair."
Locke ran a finger over the smooth skin around his lips, shaved just after dinner. There's a man behind the Midnighters. Jean and I have spent years trying to figure out which of the Duke's court it must be, but all the leads go nowhere in the end.
Even Galdo and I are stumped, added Carlo. So you know we're dealing with a devil of singular subtlety. How can you be sure, though?
Let me put it like this, Bug. Locke paused while Jean held up a false moustache. Locke shook his head and Jean went back to digging in the mask box. When Kappa Barsavi does for someone, we hear about it, right? We have connections and the word gets passed. The Kappa wants people to know his reasons. It avoids future trouble, makes an example.
And when the Duke does for someone himself, said Carlo, there's always signs. Yellow jackets, night glass soldiers, writs, trials, proclamations.
But when the spider puts the finger on someone... Locke gave a brief nod of approval to the second moustache Jean held up for consideration. When it's the spider, the poor bastard in question falls right off the face of the world, and Kappa Barsavi doesn't say a thing. Do you understand? He pretends that nothing has happened. So when you grasp that Barsavi doesn't fear the Duke, looks down on him quite a bit, actually, well, it follows that there's someone out there who does make him wet his breeches.
Oh, you mean other than the Grey King?
Carlo snorted.
This Grey King mess will be over in a few months, Bug. One lone madman against 3,000 knives, all answering to Barsavi. The Grey King is a walking corpse. The spider isn't so easily gotten rid of.
Which, said Locke, is exactly why we're hoping to see Don Salvara jump 6 feet in the air when he finds us waiting in his study. Because the Blue Bloods are no more comfortable with surprise visits from Midnighters than we are. I hate to interrupt, said Jean, but did you shave this time? Ah, good. With a small stick, he applied a glistening smear of transparent paste to Locke's upper lip. Locke wrinkled his nose in disgust. With a few quick finger motions, Jean placed the false moustache and pressed it home. In a second or two, it was set there as firmly as if it had grown naturally. This gum is made from the inner hide of a wolf shark, Jean explained for Bug's sake. And last time we used it, we forgot to pick up some of the dissolving spirit.
And I had to get rid of the moustache in a hurry, said Locke. And damned if he didn't scream when Jean did the honours, said Carlo.
Like a Sansa brother in an empty whorehouse. Locke made a rude gesture at Carlo. Carlo mimed aiming and loosing a crossbow at him in return. Scar, moustache, hair, are we done here? Jean packed the last of the disguise implements away in the mask box.
That should do it, yes.
Locke stared at his reflection in the large mirror for a moment, and when he spoke next, his voice had altered, subtly deeper, slightly rougher. His intonation was the bored humorlessness of a watch sergeant dressing down a petty offender for the 1,000th time in his career.
Let's go tell a man he's got himself a problem with some thieves.
5. So, said Don Lorenzo Salvara, you wish me to continue deliberately granting promissory notes to a man that you describe as the most capable thief in Camorre?
Respectfully, my lord Salvara, that's what you would have done anyway, even without our intervention.
When Locke spoke, there was no hint of Lucas Fairwhite in his voice or in his mannerisms. There was no trace of the Vardran merchant's restrained energy or stuffy dignity. This new fiction had the fictional backing of the Duke's incontrovertible writ. He was the sort of man who could and would tease a Don while invading the sanctity of that Don's home. Such audacity could never be faked. Locke had to feel it, summon it from somewhere inside, cloak himself in arrogance as though it were an old familiar garment. Locke Lamora became a shadow in his own mind. He was a Midnighter, an officer in the Duke's silent constabulary. Locke's complicated lies were this new man's simple truth.
The sums discussed could easily total half my available holdings.
Then give our friend Fair White Half your fortune, my lord. Choke the thorn on exactly what he desires. Promissory notes will tie him down, keep him moving back and forth between counting houses.
Counting houses that will throw my very real money after this phantom, you mean?
Yes, in the service of the Duke, no less. Take heart, my lord Salvara. His grace is entirely capable of compensating you for any loss you incur while aiding us in the capture of this man. In my opinion, though, the thorn will have time to neither spend it nor move it very far, so your stolen money should be recovered before that even becomes necessary. You must also consider the aspects of the situation that are not strictly financial.
Meaning?
His Grace's gratitude for your assistance in bringing this matter to our desired outcome, said Locke, balanced against his certain displeasure if any reluctance on your part should alert our thief to the net drawing tight around him.
Ah. Don Salvara picked his optics up and resettled them on his nose.
With that I can hardly argue.
I will not be able to speak to you in public. No uniformed member of the Camor Watch will approach you for any reason related to this affair. If I speak to you at all, it must be at night, in secret.
Am I to tell Conte to keep refreshments at hand for men coming in through the windows? Shall I tell the Doña Sofia to send any midnighters to my study if they should pop out of her wardrobe closet?
I give you my word, any future appearances will be less alarming, my lord. My instructions were to impress upon you the seriousness of the situation and the full extent of our ability to bypass obstacles. I assure you, I have no personal desire to antagonize you any further. Resecuring your fortune will be the capstone to many months of hard work on my part.
And the Doña Sofia? Has your master dictated a part for her in this counter-charade?
Your wife is a most extraordinary woman. By all means, inform her of our involvement. Tell her the truth about Lucas Fairwhite. Enlist her very capable aid in our endeavor. However,
Locke said, grinning malignantly,
I do believe that I shall regretfully leave you the task of explaining this to her on your own, my lord.
6. On the landward side of Camor, armed men paced the old stone walls of the city, ever vigilant for signs of bandits or hostile armies in the field. On the seaward side, watchtowers and war galleys served the same purpose. At the guard stations on the periphery of the Alchigrante district, the city watch stands ready to protect the city's lesser nobility from the annoyance of having to see or smell any of their actual subjects against their wishes. Locke and Carlo crossed the Angevine just before midnight on the broad glass bridge called the Eldrin Arch. This ornately carved span connected the western Alchigrante with the lush semi-public gardens of Two Silver Green, another spot where the insufficiently well-heeled were discouraged from lingering, often with whips and batons. Tall cylinders of ruby-coloured glass shed alchemical light onto the wispy threads of mist that curled and wavered below the knees of their horses. The centre of the bridge was 50 feet above the water, and the usual night fog reached no higher. The red lamps swayed gently within their black iron frames, as the muggy hangman's breeze spun them, and the two gentleman bastards rode down into the Alchigrante with that eerie light surrounding them like a bloody aura.
"Hold there! State your name and business!"
At the point where the bridge met the Angevine's north shore, there was a low wooden shack with oil-paper windows, through which a pale white glow emanated. A single figure stood beside it, his yellow tabard turned to orange in the light of the bridge lamps. The speaker's words might have been bold, but his voice was young and a little uncertain. Locke smiled. The Alchigrante guard shacks always held 2 yellow jackets, but at this one the more senior had clearly sent his less hardened partner out into the fog to do the actual work. So much the better. Locke pulled his precious sigil wallet out of his black cloak as his horse cantered down beside the guard station.
My name is immaterial.
Locke flipped the wallet open to allow the round-faced young city watchman a glimpse of the sigil by the light of his guard station.
My business is that of His Grace, Duke Nicovante.
I see, sir.
I never came this way. We did not speak. Be sure that your fellow watchman understands this as well.
The yellow jacket bowed and took a quick step backward, as though afraid to stay too close. Locke smiled. Black-cloaked riders on black horses looming out of darkness and mist. It was easy to laugh at such conceits in full daylight, but night had a way of lending weight to phantasms. If Coinkisser's Row was where Camor's money was put to use, the Alchigrande district was where it was put to rest. It was four connected islands, each a sort of tiered hill sloping up to the base of the plateau that held the five towers. Old money and new money mingled crazy quilt fashion here in mazes of manor houses and private gardens. Here the merchants and money changers and shipbrokers looked down comfortably on the rest of the city. Here the lesser nobility looked up covetously at the towers of the five families who ruled all. Carriages clattered past from time to time, their black lacquered wooden cabins trailing bobbing lanterns and banners, proclaiming the arms of whoever travelled within. Some of these were guarded by teams of armed outriders in slashed doublets and polished breastplates, this year's fashion for rented thugs. A few teams of horses wore harnesses spotted with miniature alchemical lights. These appeared at a distance, looking like chains of fireflies bobbing in the mist. Don Salvara's manor was a four-story pillared rectangle, several centuries old and sagging a bit under the weight of its years, for it had been built entirely by human hands. It was a sort of island unto itself at the heart of the Isla Durona, westernmost neighbourhood of the Alchigrante, surrounded on all sides by a 12-foot stone wall and enclosed by thick gardens. It shared no party walls with neighbouring manors. Amber lights burned behind the barred windows on the third floor. Locke and Carlo quietly dismounted in the alley adjacent to the manor's northern wall. Several long nights of careful reconnaissance by Locke and Bug had revealed the easiest routes over the alley wall and up the side of the Salvara manor. Dressed as they were, hidden by mist and darkness, they would be effectively invisible as soon as they could hop the outer wall and get off the street. A moment of fortunate stillness fell upon them as Carlo tied the horses to a weathered wooden post beside the garden wall. Not a soul was in sight. Carlo stroked his horse's thin mane.
"Hoist a glass or two in memory of us if we don't come back, love."
Locke put his back against the base of the wall and cupped his hands. Carlo set a foot in this makeshift stirrup and leapt upward, propelled by the mingled strength of his legs and Locke's arms. When he'd hoisted himself quietly and carefully atop the wall, he reached back down with both arms to hoist Locke up. The Sansa twin was as wiry as Locke was slender, and the operation went smoothly. In seconds they were both down in the wet, fragrant darkness of the garden, crouched motionless, listening. The doors on the ground floor were all protected from within by intricate clockwork fail-safes and steel bars. They simply could not be picked. But the rooftop, well, those who weren't yet important enough to live with the constant threat of assassination, often placed an inordinate degree of faith in high walls. The two thieves went up the north face of the manor house, slowly and carefully, wedging hands and feet firmly into chinks in the warm, slick stone. The first and second floors were dark and quiet. The light on the third floor was on the opposite side of the building. Hearts hammering with excitement, they hauled themselves up until they were just beneath the parapet of the roof, where they paused for a long interval, straining to catch at any sound from within the manor that would hint at discovery. The moons were stuffed away behind gauzy grey clouds. On their left, the city was an arc of blurred jewel lights shining through mist, and above them the impossible heights of the five towers stood like black shadows before the sky. The threads of light that burned on their parapets and in their windows enhanced rather than reduced their aura of menace. Staring up at them from near the ground was a sure recipe for vertigo. Locke was the first over the parapet. Peering intently by the faint light falling from above, he planted his feet on a white-tiled pathway in the center of the roof and kept them there. He was surrounded on either side by the dark shapes of bushes, blossoms, small trees, and vines. The roof was rich with the scent of vegetation and night soil. The street-level garden was a mundane affair, if well tended. This was the Doña Sofia's private botanical preserve. Most alchemical botanists, in Locke's experience, were enthusiasts of bizarre poisons. He made sure his hood and cloak were cinched tight around him and pulled his black neckcloth up over his lower face. Soft stepping along the white path, Locke and Carlo threaded their way through Sophia's garden, more carefully than if they had been walking between streams of lamp oil with their cloaks on fire. At the garden's center was a roof hatch with a simple tumbler lock. Carlo listened carefully at this door for 2 minutes with his favorite picks poised in his hands. Charming the lock took less than 10 seconds. The fourth floor. Doña Sofia's workshop. A place where the two intruders wanted even less to stumble or linger than they had in her garden. Quiet as guilty husbands coming home from a late night of drinking, they stole through the dark rooms of laboratory apparatus and potted plants, scampering for the narrow stone stairs that led downward to a side passage on the third floor. The operations of the Salvara household were well known to the gentleman bastards. The Don and Doña kept their private chambers on the third floor, across the hall from the Don's study. The second floor was the Sola, a reception and dining hall that went mostly disused when the couple had no friends over to entertain. The first floor held the kitchen, several parlors, and the servants' quarters. In addition to Conte, the Salvaras kept a pair of middle-aged housekeepers, a cook, and a young boy who served as a messenger and scullion. All of them would be asleep on the first floor. None of them posed even a fraction of a threat that Conte did. This was the part of the scheme that couldn't be planned with any precision. They had to locate the old soldier and deal with him before they could have their intended conversation with Don Salvara. Footsteps echoed from somewhere else on the floor. Locke, in the lead, crouched low and peeked around the left-hand corner. It turned out he was looking down the long passage that divided the third floor in half lengthwise. Don Salvara had left the door to his study open and was vanishing into the bedchamber. That door he closed firmly behind him, and a moment later the sound of a metal lock echoed down the hall.
"Serendipity," whispered Locke. "I suspect he'll be busy for quite some time in there. Light's still on in his study, so we know he's coming back out. Let's get the hard part over with."
Locke and Carlo slipped down the hallway, sweating now, but barely letting their heavy cloaks flutter as they moved. The long passage was tastefully decorated with hanging tapestries and shallow wall sconces in which tiny glow-glasses shed no more light than that of smouldering coals. Behind the heavy doors to the Salvara's chambers, someone laughed. The stairwell at the far end of the passage was wide and circular. Steps of white marble inset with mosaic tile maps of Camor spiraled down into the Sola. Here Carlo grabbed Locke by one sleeve, put a finger to his lips, and jerked his head downward.
"Listen,"
he murmured. Clang, clang. Footsteps. Clang, clang. The sequence of noises was repeated several times, growing slightly louder each time. Locke grinned at Carlo. Someone was pacing the Sola, methodically checking the locks and the iron bars guarding each window. At this time of the night, there was only one man in the house who'd be doing such a thing. Carlo knelt beside the balustrade, just to the left of the top of the staircase. Anyone coming up the spiral stairs would have to pass directly beneath this position. He reached inside his cloak and took out a folded leather sack and a length of narrow-gauge rope woven from black silk. He then began to thread the silk line through and around the sack in some arcane fashion that Locke couldn't follow. Locke knelt just behind Carlo, and kept one eye on the long passage they'd come down. A reappearance of the Don was hardly likely yet, but the benefactor was said to make colourful examples of incautious thieves. Conte's light, steady footsteps echoed on the staircase beneath them. In a fair fight, the Don's man would almost certainly paint the walls with Locke and Carlo's blood, so it stood to reason that this fight would have to be as unfair as possible. At the moment the top of Conte's bald head appeared beneath him, Carlo reached out between the balustrade posts and let his crimper's hood drop. A crimper's hood, for those who've never had the occasion to be kidnapped and sold into slavery in one of the cities on the Iron Sea, looks a bit like a tent as it flutters quickly downward, borne by weights sewn into its bottom edges. Air pushes its flaps outward just before it drops down around its target's head and settles on his shoulders. Conte gave a startled jerk as Carlo yanked the black silk cord, instantly cinching the hood closed around his neck. Anyone with any real presence of mind could probably reach up and fumble such a hood loose in a matter of seconds, which is why the interior is inevitably painted with large amounts of some sweet-scented fuming narcotic, purchased from a black apothecary. Knowing the nature of the man they were attempting to subdue, Locke and Carlo had spent nearly 30 crowns on the stuff Conte was breathing just now, and Locke fervently wished him much joy of it. One panic breath inside the airtight hood, that would be enough to drop any ordinary person in his or her tracks. But as Locke flew down the stairs to catch Conte's body, he saw that the man was still somehow upright, clawing at the hood, disoriented and weakened, most definitely, but still awake. A quick rap on the solar plexus, that would open his mouth and speed the drug on its way. Locke stepped in to deliver the blow, wrapping one hand around Conte's neck just beneath the crimper's hood. This nearly blew the entire game. Conte's arms flashed up and broke Locke's lackadaisical chokehold before it even began. The man's left arm snaked out to entangle Locke's right, and then Conte punched him. Once, twice, three times. Vicious jabs in his own stomach and solar plexus. With his guts an exploding constellation of pain, Locke sank down against his would-be victim, struggling for balance. Conte brought his right knee up in a blow that should have knocked Locke's teeth out of his ears at high speed, but the drug was finally, thankfully, smothering the old soldier's will to be ornery. The knee barely grazed Locke's chin. Instead, the booted foot attached to it caught him in the groin and knocked him backward. His head bounced against the hard marble of the stairs, somewhat cushioned by the cloth of his hood. Locke lay there, gasping for breath, still hanging awkwardly by one of the hooded man's arms. Carlo appeared at that instant, having dropped the line that cinched his crimper's hood and dashed down the stairs. He slipped one foot behind Conte's increasingly wobbly legs and pushed the man down the stairs, holding him by the front of his doublet to keep the fall relatively quiet. Once Conte was head down and prone, Carlo punched him rather mercilessly between the legs. Once, then again when the man's legs twitched feebly, and then again, which yielded no response. The hood had finally done its work. With Conte temporarily disposed of, Carlo turned to Locke and tried to help him to a sitting position, but Locke waved him off.
"What sort of state are you in?" Carlo whispered. "As though I'm with child and the little bastard is trying to cut his way out with an axe."
Chest heaving, Locke tore his black mask down off his face, lest he vomit inside it and create an unconcealable mess. While Locke gulped deep breaths and tried to control his shuddering, Carlo crouched back down beside Conte and tore the hood off, briskly waving away the sickly sweet aroma of the leather bag's contents. He carefully folded the hood up, slipped it into his cloak, and then dragged Conte up a few steps.
"Carlo!"
Locke coughed.
"My disguise! Damaged?" "Not that I can see. Looks like he didn't do anything that shows, provided you can walk without a slouch. Stay here a moment."
Carlo slipped down to the foot of the stairs and took a peek around the darkened solar. Soft city light fell through the barred windows, faintly illuminating a long table and a number of glass cases on the walls, holding plates and unidentifiable knick-knacks. Not another soul was in sight, and not a sound could be heard from below. When Carlo returned, Locke had pushed himself up on his knees and hands. Conte slumbered beside him with a look of comical bliss on his craggy face.
"Oh, he's not going to keep that expression when he wakes up."
Carlo waved a pair of thin, leather-padded brass knuckles at Locke, then made them vanish up his sleeves with a graceful flourish.
"I had my foot pads little friends on when I knocked him around that last time. Well, I for one have no expressions of sympathy to spare, since he kicked my balls hard enough to make them permanent residents of my lungs."
Locke tried to push himself up off his hands and failed. Carlo caught him under his right arm and eased him up until he was kneeling shakily on his knees alone.
"You've got your breath back, at least. Can you actually walk?" "I can stumble, I think. I'll be hunched over for a while. Give me a few minutes, and I think I can pretend nothing's wrong, at least until we're out of here."
Carlo assisted Locke back up the stairs to the third floor. Leaving Locke there to keep watch, he then began to quietly, slowly drag Conte up the same way. The Don's man didn't actually weigh all that much. Embarrassed and eager to make himself useful again, Locke pulled two lengths of tough cord out of his own cloak and bound Conte's feet and hands with them. He folded a handkerchief three times and used it as a gag. Locke pulled Conte's knives out of their sheaths and passed them to Carlo, who stashed them within his cloak. The Don's study door still hung open, shedding warm light into the passage. The bedchamber doors remained locked tight.
"I pray you both may be gifted with a demand and an endurance well beyond your usual expectations, my lord and lady," whispered Carlo. "Your household thieves would appreciate a short break before continuing with their duties for the evening."
Carlo grasped Conte beneath his arms, and Locke, slouched in obvious pain, nonetheless grabbed the man's feet when Carlo began to drag him all by himself. With tedious stealth, they retraced their steps and deposited the unconscious bodyguard around the far bend in the corridor, just beside the stairs leading back up to the fourth-floor laboratories. The Don's study was a most welcome sight when they finally stole in a few minutes later. Locke settled into a deeply cushioned leather armchair on the left-hand wall, while Carlo took up a standing guard position. More laughter could be heard faintly from across the hall.
"We could be here quite a while," said Carlo.
"The gods are merciful."
Locke stared at the Don's tall glass-fronted liquor cabinet, one even more impressive than the collection his pleasure barge carried.
"I'd pour us a draught or six, but I don't think it would be in character."
They waited 10 minutes, 15, 20. Locke breathed steadily and deeply, and concentrated on ignoring the throbbing ache that seemed to fill his guts from top to bottom. Yet when the two thieves heard the door across the hallway unbolting, Locke leapt to his feet, standing tall, pretending that his balls didn't feel like clay jugs dropped onto cobblestones from a great height. He cinched his black mask back on and willed a wave of perfect arrogance to claim him from the inside out. As Father Chains had once said, the best disguises were those that were poured out of the heart rather than painted on the face. Carlo kissed the back of his left hand through his own mask and winked. Don Lorenzo Salvara walked into his study whistling, lightly dressed and completely unarmed.
"Close the door," said Locke, and his voice was steady, rich with the absolute presumption of command. "Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
7. An hour past midnight, two men left the Alcigrante district via the Eldrin Arch. They wore black cloaks and had black horses. One of them rode with a leisurely air, while the other led his horse on foot, walking in a curiously bow-legged fashion.
"Unfucking believable," said Carlo. "It really did work out just as you planned. It's a pity we can't brag about this to anyone. Our biggest score ever, and all we had to do was tell our mark exactly what we were doing to him."
"And get kicked around a bit," muttered Locke.
"Yeah, sorry about that. What a beast that man was, eh? Take comfort that he'll feel the same way when he opens his eyes again."
How very comforting. If reassurances could dull pain, nobody would ever go to the trouble of pressing grapes.
"By the crooked warden, I never heard such self-pity dripping from the mouth of a wealthy man. Cheer up! Richer and cleverer than everyone else, right?"
Richer and cleverer and walking funny, yes. The pair of thieves made their way south through Two Silver Green, toward the first of the stops, where they would gradually lose their horses and shed their black clothes, until they were finally heading back to the temple district dressed as common labourers. They nodded companionably at patrols of yellow jackets, stomping about in the mist with lanterns swaying on pike poles to light their way. Not once were they given any reason to glance up. The fluttering shadow that trailed them on their way through the streets and alleys was quieter than a small child's breath. Swift and graceful, it swooped from rooftop to rooftop in their wake, following their actions with absolute single-mindedness. When they slipped back into the temple district, it beat its wings and rose into the darkness in a lazy, spiraling circle until it was up above the mists of Camor and lost against the grey haze of the low-hanging clouds. Interlude. The Last Mistake. 1. Locke's first experience with the mirror wine of Tal Verar had even more of an effect on the boy's malnourished body than Chains had expected. Locke spent most of the next day tossing and turning on his cot, his head pounding and his eyes unable to bear anything but the most gentle spark of light.
"It's a fever,"
Locke muttered into his sweat-soaked blanket.
"It's a hangover."
Chains ran a hand through the boy's hair and patted his back.
"My fault, really. The Sansa twins are natural liquor sponges. I shouldn't have let you live up to their standard on your first night with us. No work for you today."
"Liquor does this, even after you're sober?"
"A cruel joke, isn't it? The gods put a price tag on everything, it seems, unless you're drinking Osterschellen brandy."
"Offershallow?"
"Osterschellen. From Emberlane. Among its many other virtues, it doesn't cause a hangover. Some sort of alchemical component in the vineyard soil. Expensive stuff."
False light came after many hours of half-sleep, and Locke found himself able to walk once again, though the brain within his skull felt like it was attempting to dig a hole down through his neck and escape. Chains insisted that they would still be visiting Kappa Barsavi.
"The only people who break appointments with him are the ones that live in glass towers and have their pictures on coins, and even they think twice."
Though he consented to allow Locke a more comfortable means of transportation. It turned out that the House of Perelandro had a small stable tucked around the back, and in this smelly little stall there lived a gentled goat.
"He's got no name,"
Chains said, as he set Locke atop the creature's back.
"I just couldn't bring myself to give him one, since he wouldn't answer to it anyway."
Locke had never developed the instinctive revulsion most boys and girls felt for gentled animals. He'd already seen too much ugliness in his life to care about the occasional empty stare from a docile, milky-eyed creature. There is a substance called wraithstone, a chalky white material found in certain remote mountain caverns. The stuff doesn't occur naturally. It is found only in conjunction with glass-lined tunnels, presumably abandoned by the Eldrin, the same unsettling race that built Camor ages past. In its solid state, wraithstone is tasteless, nearly odorless, and inert. It must be burned to activate its unique properties. Physicists have begun